Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week we're rethinking mental illness. Plus our weekly news and disabled people's update with Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square. Well, I'm joined this week by Karen Allen from Rethink Mental Illness. Hi, Karen, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. Nice for inviting you. Thank you.
What is Rethink Mental Illness?
It's a national charity. And we support people with mental illness, and we also support the families and friends of people who have mental illnesses.
And are you just in Bristol or all over the country?
All over the country.
Now, yes. We see the Mind as a mental illness charity that's got quite a high public profile. It's got sort of charity shops in the high streets, that kind of thing. How do you raise your money? Because I've not heard of Rethink Mental Illness before.
Yeah, we don't have charity shops, which is perhaps why you don't see us on the high street so much. But what we do have is services often which are commissioned by local authorities. So, for example, in Bristol, my salary is paid mainly by Bristol City Council, but we are also a membership organisation, so anybody can join Rethink Mental Illness, and they pay a certain amount of money per year to join. I think it's about £22, something like that. And it's a campaigning charity, so we're also looking to influence government policy when the new Mental Health Act came up for revision, for example. We were quite a strong voice representing thousands of people.
Well, since you've done that, why don't you tell me, how has the law changed to do with mental illness over the last few years?
Well, there was a new law which looked at things like treating people, community treatment orders. There have been changes to laws about how much treatment people can get and what say they have or don't have about their treatment when they are released from hospital on a community treatment order. And there have been quite a few revisions. There's just been recently a revision about that, and they've been reviewing whether that's been successful and popular in Parliament recently.
Because this is one of the really controversial things to do with mental illness, isn't it? That people can almost completely lose their rights if they're sectioned under the Mental Health Act. Really, their life is not their own. You know, what sort of protection is there to make sure that sort of thing isn't abused?
Well, it's funny because I was just reading a novel the other day which was talking exactly about this, and they had their facts completely wrong, because in the novel it was actually based in Bristol, and they were saying that a GP's word was enough to commit somebody under the Mental Health Act, when actually It is quite an involved process, and it requires a medical opinion plus a social worker, and they have to be specially approved, and they have to both give their opinion that that person would be better off in hospital. And there are different lengths of section as well. So the shortest one is 72 hours just for assessment, and normally somebody then would have a review. So there are quite a lot of checks in place so that somebody's human rights are respected.
Oh, that's good to hear. Tell us a bit more about Rethink Mental Illness, though. Is it in the cities? Is it regional right across the southwest?
It's it really depends on the area. So there are different tenders that go out, and Rethink, among other organisations, will apply for that to provide a service. So, for example, in Bristol, we have a carers service, we have a black and minority ethnic service, and we have community services which directly support people with mental illnesses. I think in North Devon we have an advocacy service, in Dorset we have a dementia service, so it really depends what the local authority want in that particular area and what the result of the tender is.
Now, these are the sorts of things that surely used to be done by local authority or local NHS. Now they're being done by you. What's the difference? Is there any difference, or is it just the different people doing it?
I think there is a difference. For example, in Bristol, we work very closely with mental health services. And some of the, for example, we work in Froomside, which is a secure hospital up at Blackberry Hill. And we've run a friends and family group for several years. And the friends and family requested that they had time with Rethink after the sort of educational aspect of the evening, because they didn't want things that they fed back to have any impact on the care of their relative. So they felt it was more appropriate to talk to an organisation that wasn't directly providing the care. And I think, you know, in the course which we're going to offer in October, which I'll tell you more about, called Caring and Coping, we actually delivered the course together with somebody from mental health services. But because we're a charity, we don't have a vested interest in saying our services are fantastic, but neither do we have an interest in saying they're terrible and you shouldn't, for example, take up services that are offered in the community or in hospital. So it's a matter of, I think, different perspectives. Very often we have more an idea of, well, it could be anybody who suffers from a mental illness, and quite a few of the people who work at Rethink have experienced mental illness themselves. So we come very much from the point of view of, there but the grace of God walk you or I, really.
Well, you've raised a really important point there, haven't you? Because I can remember back in the 1990s when there was a book being put together, I think it was by one of the Dimblebees, about Princess Diana. There was a whole chapter written about her being mentally ill, which was then actually taken out of the book before it was published, because there was a lot of different opinions as to whether Diana was mentally ill. How do you define whether someone is or whether someone isn't? Because this is often used, I think, as a sort of a way of accusing people, saying, you know, because you behave differently, you must be mentally ill.
Well, I suppose ultimately it's every person who decides for themselves whether they consider that it would be helpful to have a diagnosis or not, because many people feel that it is, because then they can get some treatment. But many people also feel, well, actually, I don't want to be labelled, I don't want to be recorded anywhere on any computer as having some particular label. So I think it's really up to each individual to decide for themselves, in a sense.
But I mean, someone could be very, very peculiar, couldn't they? Extremely strange, and maybe even sectioned, and still denying that they are actually mentally ill.
Well, that's actually very common in the families that I support. Obviously, it's quite a severe situation when you have somebody who's saying they're absolutely fine. Perhaps they visit their GP and the GP is trying to help the family get some help for this person, but the person is saying, no, I'm absolutely fine, I don't need any help. And the family is actually having to provide all the support and make them feel as safe as possible without having any support from anybody else, any professionals. And I know families where this has gone on for years and years, and it's very stressful.
I suppose it works the other way around as well, isn't it? Some of our world leaders might be considered totally psychopathic, possibly, you know. Your course you mentioned that's coming up, tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so the course is called Caring and Coping, and we are offering it free of charge to people who either live in Bristol or support somebody in Bristol. And we're talking about I don't really like that word support, but what it means is if you've got a family member or a friend who has depression or perhaps bipolar disorder or hears voices or for some reason has an experience of the world which makes it very difficult for them to fit in and do the things that they want to do. And this concerned person is providing them with, you know, it might be a phone call every day to see whether they're all right. It might be that they live together and they're actually doing quite a lot for this person during the times that they're not well. And that's quite a skill, really, to know when to be there, when to back off, what's helpful to say, what's not helpful to say, and how to navigate the mental health system if that's part of the plan. So this course is designed specifically for family members and friends to help people discuss together and learn about what are helpful ways to intervene, really.
Well, I mean, I could say I did a bit of voluntary work back in the 1990s with the mentally ill, and it was actually very challenging, actually really challenging. So I think, you know, it's probably very valuable to have done the course. Now, I'm also joined by Fran, who's done the course. Fran, tell us what was it like?
It was just great, actually, to, first of all, to be in contact with lots of other people who are in a similar situation, who have also experienced providing support for someone who's mentally ill, because you can feel quite isolated.
Can you tell us, give us an example of something in the course that really helped you? Maybe, you know, even just chatting to someone else who'd come along on the same day to share with them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a part of the course, they had people coming in to talk, you know, who'd had previous experience of being on the course and having support from Rethink. And so that was really helpful because they were kind of sharing just lots of little techniques of, you know, so it almost kind of gives you a little toolkit of things that you can use, just ideas that you can use, because obviously every person is different, so there's something that works for one person isn't necessarily going to work for the next person, but just to have that sharing. And one of the other things that was quite useful was we had different guest speakers come in who worked within mental health services, so they gave us a kind of clear idea of, you know, where we could turn for support, what organisations there are, you know, because there's lots and lots of different organisations, but how to access those organisations and then what to do in a crisis.
So now you've got a family member who's mentally ill. How do you find, you know, coping, you know, day to day?
Well, it goes up and down. I mean, sometimes I'm absolutely fine, but other times it can get very, very stressful. You know, it's not nice to see someone that you care about really ill. It's not fun at all. And sometimes you just don't really know what to do or say to best help that person. So it is a challenge. I mean, you know, with mental illness, it can go up and down. So, you know, they can have good days and bad days. So on a good day, it might be fine. It might be fine for a couple of weeks. But then you might go through a challenging phase where they're very angry or they're very sad or they're very depressed. So yeah, it's a constant challenge, really.
Karen, how would you encourage people to keep going when it helping mentally ill people? Because I think one of the things that I've come across is that sometimes it can make you want to disengage. You know, sometimes things are taken the wrong way by someone who's mentally ill. You're trying to help, and it's taken the wrong way. How can you just encourage people to keep going? Because sometimes, I mean, certainly my experience of this is that it can be really quite soul-destroying when you're trying to help somebody that actually, maybe just for a short period of time, really doesn't want any help at all.
Yeah, and very often you might find that the person who's closest at times is the person who's identified as a problem by the person who's unwell. And sometimes that's a characteristic of somebody's illness, is that they do push people away who are trying to help them. And that would be very different perhaps when they're well. So it can be extremely challenging. And I think the thing I would encourage somebody to do is to do something they really enjoy that allows them to completely forget about all the difficulties they're experiencing. So it might be going swimming, it might be going away for a day to Bath Spa, it might be buying a new pair of shoes. And the good news is that there is actually a fund held by the Carers Integrated team at Bristol City Council for exactly that reason. It's a carers fund and it can be accessed through Rethink, for example, or through other organisations, and it's for people to decide for themselves what they think might be fun for them and helpful in order to lower their stress levels.
Sounds good. Sounds quite useful. Now, back in the 1960s and 70s and in and 80s, many mentally ill people were looked after in asylums, and then we had something called Care in the Community came along. Virginia Bottomley, I seem to remember, was health secretary at the time, and I must admit at the time I was very cynical about it. I was thinking this is just really about just letting people look after themselves, maybe giving them a bit of money, a little bit of support if things go wrong. But my experience of some of the mental health centres, hospitals, was actually fairly positive. People felt that they'd come in for a short period of time and that there was some real help for them, concentrated help. They were often in very nice environments as well, you know, close to the edges of the cities. So what's your thoughts about care in the community and whether it's really worked or not? Because nobody likes the idea of an institution, a massive building full of the mentally ill. But it seems that maybe people who are mentally ill were sort of pushed away from the system and left to their own devices a bit too much with that. What's your views?
Well, I know quite a few staff who used to work at Barrow Hospital, which was closed when Callington Road Hospital was opened. And I think I wasn't in Bristol when Barrow Hospital was open. And I think what has my role in Rethink Mental Illness is particularly to do with hospital liaison. So I go to hospitals and talk to carers there. So basically visitors, and buttonholing visitors and saying, you know, how are you doing with this situation, and do you need a bit of a listening ear yourself? And I think that hospital stays generally now are much shorter. They're much more targeted towards getting somebody sleeping, eating, taking their medication, and sort of having a rhythm which is going to sustain their mental health better than whatever they have been doing before they came into hospital. But the stays are much, much shorter than they used to be. And I think they're very, very useful for some people at times. But obviously, when people are in the community, there's less stigma involved in, you know, being part of society. And I think people do get institutionalised. If you go into a hospital and you stay there too long, you get used to having your meals provided for you, and you are mixing with people who are quite unwell. And that can be very, very disturbing. So I think there's, you know, it's, as Fran said, there's no one answer for any particular person, but I think different situations require different levels of support, and hospital can be brilliant for some people.
Now, one of the things was also, if you talk to the police, you'll often hear them talking about mental illness, saying that they're more than ever finding people in the police cells who really should be being looked after by the mental health teams. Why is that?
Well, it kind of goes back, I think, in some situations to what you were saying before about somebody being detained under the Mental Health Act, because very often for that to occur, somebody has to do something which means that either they get arrested or they're displaying behaviour in public, which means they're either, you know, potentially are going to harm themselves or going to harm somebody else. And that's when they will end up in a police station. And often there is actually now a place at the hospital, which is for people who are on, I think it's section 117, which means that it's a safe place. And each area has a safe place for people who have a mental illness and have been perhaps picked up by the police because they are in danger or dangerous.
So do you spend much time in police stations? Because when I think of mental health, I think, well, yes, I mean, this is something which is on the periphery of society, but the police are often picking up the pieces when things go wrong.
I don't personally spend any time in police stations, but we do have posters there in different languages. And I think you're absolutely right. It's often the first port of call for people who really need help, and they need medical help. They don't need... to be criminalised.
Fran, can you just give us an idea of why you think, you know, you got so much out of the course, and tell us a bit more about that side of things. How has it changed for you with your family?
Well, it's just really helped me to get a kind of clearer picture of, you know, the sort of structure that is there to provide support, not just for my family member, but for me. And I think, you know, with anything, I think education is really, really important. It can really just help you to understand and help you to have compassion for the person who's not well. And I just think that the course was brilliant, because the way that the course was delivered was very, very sensitive. You know, they really understand what it is like for people who are supporting people who are mentally ill. So, you know, and they were really there for the carers, you know.
And for your particular family member, is there anything you think society could do to support them more? I'm not just thinking about the people who are supporting them, but, you know, the institutions, the doctors, the mental health teams.
Well, I think there's a lot of stigma attached to mental illness, isn't there? And I think the less stigma that there is, the easier it would be for people to actually talk about their problems. And actually talking about it might enable people to access help before they get to the stage of being really ill. Because I think in our society, that it's all too easy for people to turn to drugs and alcohol when, you know, they haven't got anyone to talk to. So they kind of end up self-medicating. And I think that's the danger, really. And I think we just need to be more open about it, be just more able to kind of use terms like bipolar and depression. You know, that's something, because actually, you know, I think anybody could become mentally ill. It just depends what you go through in your life. And quite often it's just a reaction to circumstances, I think.
Okay. Karen, this whole business of turning to drugs and alcohol, do you find that's quite common when people can't cope?
Very much so, yes. And the difficulty is sorting out which came first. So sometimes it's hard for somebody who's using drugs or alcohol to get help for their mental illness, because they may be seen as somebody with a drug or alcohol problem, when actually, initially, it was maybe that they were hearing voices and they started self-medicating because that actually... stilled the voices, or perhaps made them less of a problem for them. So there are specialised services that treat dual diagnosis, but sometimes it can be quite difficult for somebody to get the right kind of help.
What about some of the drugs to alleviate mental illness? People get put on, they can get addicted to the drug, can't they? Is there any way to help wean people off of these? Because, you know, particularly young people sometimes get put on these things, and I'm thinking of things like Ritalin and, you know, things that which are supposed to sort of calm you down when you're too hyperactive. And there are other drugs to do with more to do focused on mental people with mental illness. What about helping to understand how those drugs are working, and if possible, to stop the dependency on them?
Yeah, there's an organisation called Battle Against Tranquilizers, which. You know, has been...
Is it really a battle?
Well, that's the name of their organisation. I haven't experienced it myself, but I think it can be very much so. And we, on Rethink's website, there are a lot of fact sheets which you can download and print off, including things about side effects of medication and perhaps dependency and things like that. So that might be a helpful resource.
Okay, so where is your website?
So that's www.rethink, that's with a K on the end, .org.
Rethink.org. Well, Karen Allen, have you got any other points of contact, like phone number, that sort of thing?
Yes, if you want to find out more about the Caring and Coping course, you can phone me, and my number is 0117 903 1803.
Well, Karen Allen, thanks very much, and also Fran, thank you too, and I'll give the number again at the end of the show if you didn't catch it.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks.
Thank you.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
And now I'm joined by Anisa Mirra. Hi, Anisa.
Hello.
And it's your final week. This is terrible. You're going back. Whereabouts are you going back to study?
Worcester.
Back to Worcester to study. That's not too far. It's only a few junctions up on the M5, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so it's not too far.
So we'll have to phone you at the weekend and get you to come back down at some point. But anyway, this week's report is about virtual identities online. Now, for those that don't go online a lot, what is a virtual identity?
Basically, the online world is huge. You have so many different social medias, such as Facebook or Twitter, LinkedIn. Basically, you sort of set up an account, put your name online, picture if you want to. Basically, you're sort of, not in a way sort of selling yourself, but you're basically showing people who you are. But the trouble is that it's not, I don't know whether it's a good or bad thing, being that you can obviously fake your identity, being right. that it's an open source.
Well, I suppose the obvious thing is, if you don't use your real name, then you can kind of be maybe a little bit ruder. And I mean, this seems to me to be one of the things that seems to go with these fake identities online. But then again, people might justifiably think that I don't want to go online using my real name because I don't want people to necessarily be able to trace me and find me. I mean, there are occasions, aren't there, where people using their real name have actually been sacked from their jobs, for example, just because of something they said on Facebook.
That's very true. I actually knew of someone who decided not to go into work one day and then posted a link on Facebook about what he was doing, and then he stupidly sort of rode past his workplace on the same day and he got fired. But I mean, I guess it's a good thing that some people obviously want to hide their identity and protect themselves, because like I said, the internet is such a big source that obviously people could hack in, like there's spam and there's hacking into things, so I understand that aspect. But I think people do get carried away if they decide to obviously portray a false identity, and that could, well, whether they obviously, it could be a bad thing, because if they're a lot meaner, social bullying kind of comes into it, and then that sort of, I know there's, we read like cases where people have either self-harmed themselves or thought they didn't like their personality or themselves personally and have been afraid to tell others because some random person across the world started bullying them or being really mean to them.
Well, that's awful, isn't it? We've heard quite a few of these sorts of cases. What can you do if you are using your real name and people start bullying you, maybe using real names or other names? What can you do?
I think you should definitely be aware of it. I was having this conversation with my friend a few weeks ago, and we were basically agreed that if you do sign up to a social networking site, I know a lot of people, there's terms and conditions, a lot of people don't read it. There should at least still be sort of a huge sign which sort of displays whether there could be certain there's certain reasons or there's situations where people could be unfair to you, and that you should obviously be aware of it. And then here are the obviously actions that you can take towards it, because obviously you can report people, you can report abuse and stuff like that, but I think people don't really like take notice of that because they're like, oh well, I can just connect with my friends, I can keep in touch with my friends.
Well, it may be also that you can just unfriend the person who, or whatever, or disconnect from the person who's been rude to you without actually reporting it. And it's probably quite useful for these companies, the internet companies, to know when people are abusing the system.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, what about the other side of all of this, which is if you're using your real face, your real name on things like Facebook, all your real friends posting real-time information, that this actually could be useful to criminals?
Exactly. Obviously, the more you put online, I mean, I think I was having a discussion earlier, and obviously you could put your profile on private, you put it on public. However, Dave mentioned that if you actually type in someone's email address on the Facebook search tool, it still comes up with their profile, and I didn't know that. So I think obviously there's a lot of ways to sort of go around it, and I guess that's a good thing.
That's a bit annoying, isn't it? Because surely these companies like Facebook could block that. I mean, you're referring to our engineer Dave there. He seems to know quite a lot about the internet, far more than I do. And maybe we should be bringing him in on the discussion at some point. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that a lot of the things that we're putting online, we don't actually really have control of or knowledge of how far it's going. So exactly. I suppose the message from you is to go into the things like the terms and conditions when you've signed up, go back and have a look at those.
Yeah.
And also to be very aware of the settings on these various websites, so you're very clear about what you're allowing Joe Public to have a look at and what only people that you're you've definitely sort of identified and recognized as real people and real friends. So what about deciding what you put online and what you don't put online?
Well, Facebook in particular has become such a huge aspect. Like, people use it more often than they probably talk to people or interact with people on the phone.
That is frightening, isn't it?
It is really frightening. I kind of go on and off my Facebook. I sometimes go on it for like I sometimes get obsessed with it, sometimes I hardly use it. And there's this thing where you either are not you're not properly in a relationship if it's not Facebook official. And I think that's just a bit silly though, because obviously before Facebook everyone wasn't, you'd be like, oh, I'm dating this person, you'd be like, oh, good for you. You're not really relying on like an internet, which probably is not the truth, which is probably very unlikely, but it could not be the truth.
What do you mean by Facebook official?
That on Facebook you can update your status, relationship status, and basically it's on your profile, you edit it, and you obviously put your own relationship, you can tag the person in it, obviously if they have Facebook themselves, and it comes up with on a newsfeed or on your actual profile page, it comes up with a huge block and it displays it, and
it's probably big love hearts. Yeah, yeah, I'm just exactly. I've never actually seen that, but I got it right.
Very cliche.
And it's really a way of, in a way, that's kind of stalking, you know, it leaves people open to stalking, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, obviously people go, oh my, well, especially like girls who like the same guy could be like, oh my god, what's going on? And also it's a bit like it segregates other people, because if you're not in that sort of status, you're not in that little bubble, people sort of like, obviously you're probably not unattractive or not that sociable, probably stay away from that profile page for a bit, because I'd rather be on the most popular profile page to sort of know what's going on.
So anyway, why do we rely so much on technology, and is it affecting the younger generation, do you think?
I don't know. Well, I think it's become easier and it's something new. Obviously, our body, like our brain has adapted it so much, and it's everywhere, and people are like, oh, check this out. And obviously, I guess people obviously want to be in the loop. But I do think it is dangerous for younger children, just because obviously their minds are like sponges and they absorb everything. I know my younger brother who is obsessed with the Xbox at the moment, and I see him play it for about 3 hours straight, and I'm like, get off it now. I'm his older sister, not his mum, but I'm still like, get off it now, because it's really bad for you. Like, go run around. Like, I used to play football and like be outside all the time throughout my childhood, so I think it does make children a bit lazy. I mean, I know that obviously we have our phones and we're constantly on it, and obviously we become a lot lazier. There's like the iPhone, and they have Siri, which you could just talk and the person's name just to call it rather than typing in, which I think is absolutely ridiculous.
Well, I was chatting to a piano teacher the other day who teaches a lot of youngsters the piano, and she was saying that if they are told to switch off, which she does tell them to switch off their phone, they go crazy. Some of them actually start getting really nervous that there might be some message coming into them that they haven't got, and they're supposed to be concentrating for an hour on learning the piano. I mean, do you come across that almost like obsessive attitude?
I do. My friends are like that, which is surprising. If they've broken their phone or if they've either lost it, they're like, oh, I don't know what to do now. My manager the other day said the exact same thing. She said, oh, she'd forgotten her phone, but obviously she had a lot of contacts. But she still said, I still feel lost without my phone. Like, everyone who I've spoken to who doesn't have a phone at the moment are like, oh, damn, I don't know what to do. Because they've always constantly had something in their hand. And if you're not having something in your hand, you're like, I'm kind of stuck. But that's kind of dangerous, because if for some reason we all phones were wiped out and everyone was just stood there, I feel like we'd all be like lost, like little children, like starting to learn again the basics.
I have a friend who's a photographer who was out in Egypt during the Arab Spring in Cairo, and she said that when they switched off the internet, which they did at one point during the Arab Spring in Egypt, what happened is everybody came out onto the streets. who'd been sitting behind their computers and they'd been and so maybe the day they switch off Facebook will be the day we start actually going to parks and doing stuff in the real world again.
I really hope so.
Anyway, Anisa Mira, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you.
We'll hope you come back the next holidays.
Hopefully.
From university.
Thank you very much.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
And the voice we're going to hear now is that of Jason, the one and only Yiannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hello, there's a voice inside your head.
I'm afraid so. And it's you and I.
Or at least inside your ear.
So, outcry over Vodafone this week. They're avoiding paying tax again. What's going on?
It's £84 billion following the sale of its stake in a US rival. That US, it's received an £84 billion windfall from the sale of its stake in Verizon, the mobile phone giant from America.
Okay, so that amount of that they're not paying tax on would build how many tens of thousands of low-cost houses around the country?
Oh, I do not know that.
I would say, let's guess, 100,000.
Oh, wow.
Possibly?
Yes. The argument they put forward is that the holding company that owns its US stake is based in the Netherlands and therefore is not liable to British tax.
Well, hang on a minute. Isn't it UK Uncut? They may have something to say about this, haven't they? Because they've been on the case of Vodafone as being one of the worst companies in Britain for actually paying any tax on all the money they make. How do they get away with this, Jason?
Well, it's quite a complex system we have here. But to sort of explain it in a little bit, even if the company is based in the UK, the bank responsible for the holding company responsible for some of the deals that they do might not be based in the UK, and under current rules that means that they don't have to pay UK tax.
I mean, isn't that called a shell company, where that company is just purely set up to avoid tax?
Indeed, that is and that's pretty much what they've done here.
I suppose anyone could do that, couldn't they? So anyone out there, if you're paying tax, set up a shell company and you don't have to do it anymore. Like Vodafone. Vodafone are leading the way to no tax government.
Yeah, this isn't something you should be encouraging.
No, I know. I'm being slightly ironic, but they it seems to be like a free for all. Like the law doesn't really matter anymore.
It is horrific that they get away with this. In fact, Margaret Hodge, the Labour MP for Barking, who is the chairwoman of the Public Accounts Committee, she said, "We need assurance from that Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs has done its damnedest to make sure taxpayers receive the highest amount. If there are flaws in the legislation, Treasury ministers should look at this urgently."
Well, I wonder if they will, because they seem to be too busy spending time with these fracking people arranging tax breaks for them. I think the Treasury diary is completely full. So, anyway, next story.
I think that's fracking unfair.
the next story, fraudsters are getting away with it.
Yes, again, this one's also from the Eye. This one's Nick Kuchan. He's talking about the serious fraud office targets countries. Biggest economic criminals. It's a massive job, but a growing number of them are getting away with it. So it says here that Britain becomes the closest you can get to an offshore island that is not the Caribbean. It's largely due to mismanagement for the Serious Fraud Office, which over recent years the private eyes refer to as the Serious Farce Office. It's facing legal threats from one of its targets after a completely bungled raid. A committee of MPs has attacked for overpayment to departing employees amid cronyism allegations. Most recently, it lost a massive tranche of documents.
Oh, that's right. I remember that was relating to a bribery deal with BAE Systems, wasn't it? And then they suddenly lost them.
Yeah, I think lost some in inverted commas.
Some of the documents were then found again, not by the Serious Fraud Office, but by some investigative journalist hiding in a warehouse somewhere next to a cannabis factory. So I don't know quite what they were doing there. But so the Serious Fraud Office, Jason, it seems to be actually arranging fraud rather than actually stopping it.
This is exactly the problem. I mean,
no wonder they call it serious.
Well, David Green, the head of the CFO, the Serious Fraud Office, is trying to bring through some changes, but the government can't really wait for that. So
if you want to do a bit of serious fraud, that's the place to go.
Do it now. No.
Okay, yes. And another story was in the Mirror. That's the Tories wasting £2 billion in carrier chaos. Carrier chaos? What's that? Carrier bags?
Sadly not. It's aircraft carriers.
Oh, dear.
It's the problem they've had with the super carriers, which are supposed to be coming in for 2016.
Hang on. No, they're not so super carriers.
Yeah, indeed. They were supposed to be coming in for 2016, but now, or 2018, at a cost of £3.65 billion. But now it looks like they might cost £5.5 billion. We've got no idea when they're going to come in. So
just go through those figures. Hang on a minute. Go through those figures again. It's gone from
£3.65 billion to costing £5.5 billion.
Oh, so that's an extra £2 billion. How did that happen?
Whoops. The problem is that the Tories dumped Labour's plan to buy some jump jet style strike fighter aircraft in favour of some more high spec jets. But the cost of equipment for planes to take off and land has doubled.
So I can imagine whoever's building these going back to the government saying, well, really sorry. Well, you know all that money you've already spent on the carrier.
In fact, this actually had to be abandoned, this plan, because it costs the taxpayers £74 million.
What, without actually getting a bean for it?
No.
Oh. This sounds like Private Eye, but it's not. It's just the eye without the private, isn't it?
This is actually the Mirror.
Oh, it's the Mirror, that one. Okay, so disaster. Does it mean that we just don't have any aircraft carriers at the moment?
Well, we have aircraft carriers. They're just massively out of date. Again, this went to Margaret Hodge, who we mentioned not so long ago. She said, when this programme got green-lighted in 2007, we were supposed to get two carriers available from 2016-2018 at a cost of £3.5 billion. And they now, of course, spend £5.5 million. She says that we don't have any aircraft carrier capability for nearly a decade. She slammed the rush decision taken in 2010 to change the type of aircraft flown from these carriers.
Okay, so this was just after the Condem government came in. They changed the specification, and so they've bumped up the price massively, or at least helped to. You do wonder, I mean, how much of this is just... I mean, if the military cannot actually get proper equipment out of this government, who can? Because, I mean, you know, if the equipment is not arriving, you would imagine they might turn up Downing Street in their tanks and saying, where's our stuff?
That would be entertaining to watch.
The trouble, of course, is the defence contractors that are bumping these prices up. Anyway, finally, Jason, the lobby bill will silence free speech. Hang on a minute, because the lobby bill was designed to stop big business, big companies from getting too much access to the Houses of Parliament, too much access to Downing Street. But it sounds to me, from what this headline you've given me here saying, is that actually it's going to silence free speech rather than silence the rich and powerful.
Yes, sadly. What charities can currently spend up to a year before election is £989,000. They might now be capped at £390,000. That's a cut of almost £600,000.
But this was the whole point of this was because of the lobbying scandal, wasn't it? This is to do with Bell Pottinger, who are sort of a super PR firm. What's called strategic communications firm, these massive companies that do things like fix elections, and you can pay them however many million to you know, get a particular person in power in a country.
The Labour Party claim that it will only cover 1% of lobbying and lets big businesses off the hook. And not only that, but it may gag charities who may no longer have enough money to set up a proper campaign.
Well, I know one of the charities that's been complaining about that this week, Jason, is Crisis, who try and make sure, even just for a few weeks over Christmas, that people who are sleeping on the streets have got a roof over their head, just for a few weeks.
And this is terrible. I mean, the National Council for Voluntary Organisations is concerned. It's actually so concerned it's written to Parliament with the backing of charities including Shelter, Royal British Legion, British Heart Foundation, the Guide Dogs.
The British Legion as well? Yeah. I mean, this is the old soldiers from the Second World War and people who fought for this country over many years. So they are also going to be gagged.
Yep. pretty much.
Well, it sounds to me like we've got the worst government this country's ever had. I mean, they're supposed to be stopping the rich and powerful, like the banks, lobbying government. And actually what they've done is they've stopped old soldiers and the British Legion lobbying
the problem is, as has been made by... a point that's been made by Carl Winding, who is the policy director of the National Council of Voluntary Organisation. He made a point that at the moment, if you intend to influence an election to be in trouble, but the wording's being changed to say, if you have the effect of influencing an election, you should be in trouble.
Well, that's ridiculous, because that's what charities are trying to do. They're trying to change things. They're trying to campaign. And it might actually be that they might want to campaign for one party rather than another party at an election. Are you saying they won't be able to do that?
Pretty much. I mean, the big problem is that big corporate giants will be able to afford to pay sort of £5,000 and probably won't. They'll probably have to spend out a bit more, but they probably won't feel that too much. Unlike the charities, who will be capped at this because they count under the bill. And if they want to spend anything more than that, then they have to register as a third party with the Electoral Commission.
Right, and that's a whole another load of bureaucracy going forward. But so basically, it's going to be a lot easier for the rich and powerful than it is for the charities. That sounds absolutely crazy.
I mean, the point made here is Hope Not Hate, the Daily Mail-backed anti-racism group, said it could hamper their work. The bill would slash the amount they can spend on campaigning in the run-up to an election by up to 70%, but it wouldn't affect somebody like the British National Party, who are a political party, and this is...
How frustrating. Anyway... a little bit of despair, Jason, I feel, because one wonders how we're going to sort this all out. We have to wait till the next election before this government, or is it over the Syria business? Do you think Cameron could be on the way out?
Well, I hate to say it, but I don't think the Syria business is going to be enough to topple him. I mean, Liberal Democrats are going to keep him there because they're probably not going to see another chance of having power for a very long time. So, you know.
Okay, so next time you see a Liberal Democrat, pat them on the back and say thank you for keeping this government in there. All right, Jason Yannakopoulos, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tony. Bristol Community FM
93.2. It's Jeff Sparks. It's the What's On. Sorry, we missed you last week, Jeff, but what we got this week?
Thank you, Tony. This is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting on Friday, 6th of September, Guns N' Roses and Metallica Reloaded will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 6:30 p.m. Also on 6th of September, GBH will be performing with support from Boots and All at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, the presenter Joyce Grenfell. She was an English actress, comedian and singer-songwriter, and her career spanned over 30 years. This song is from the album It Was a Funny Old Life, and is a duet she performed with Norman Wisdom, and it's titled Narcissus.
I love that tune.
Yes, it is nice, isn't it? Catchy.
What is it, Norman?
I don't know. Well, I know it. It goes... That's it, isn't it? You must remember
yes.
This. You've heard it before.
Oh, dear. Go on, Norman.
Shall I?
Yes, you've got an awfully nice voice.
Oh, silly.
No, I mean it.
La la. La 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 la.
La
la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la la.
Change of key.
What's that?
Different notes, silly.
Oh. La la la. I mean, I got it. That's it. La 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 la. Don't need it.
Sorry.
La 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 la
la la la la la la la.
What's going down?
Too low for me.
It's going up again, it's alright. I've lost it.
We'll find it, don't worry.
Well, here it comes.
Yeah.
You know what this reminds me of, don't you?
What? Oh, yes. Ruining the music, this is.
Oh, breathe.
You'll go all bang in a minute.
Don't laugh.
I can't help it. Oh, no.
Gosh, that's a bit of a painful laugh there, Jeff. Who is she with there, do you know?
She was with Sir Norman Wisdom.
Oh, really?
And that was recorded in 1954.
Fantastic. Anyway, that's the way they used to do things back in the 1950s. I'm not sure if you'd see that released as a single today.
No, I don't think you will.
Okay, on with the What's On then.
Thank you. That was Joyce Grenfell and Norman Wisdom with Narcissus. Moving into Saturday, 7th of September, and it's the first annual Old Market Music Festival, featuring acts such as Yes Rebels, Radio Nasties, Forgery Lit, Armchair Committee and Deaf Horse at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Entry is free and the event starts at 3 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 8th of September, Peter Hook and The Light will be performing New Order's Movement album and Power, Corruption and Lies album in full at the Fleet in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £20 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. And finally, just a reminder of the details for Rethink Mental Illness and Karen Allen's phone number, who was in earlier on. And the course she's doing is called Caring and Coping. It's between Wednesday the 9th of October and the 4th of December. It's every Wednesday evening between 5 and 7:30 p.m. at the City of Bristol College on College Green. That's Wednesday the 9th of October is the first of that Caring and Coping course. And you can contact Karen at 0117 903 1803. That's 0117 903 1803. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on our new schedule on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to us at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks very much to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fire, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true lover man. If you go when the snowflakes storm, when the rivers freeze and summer ends, please see she has a coat so warm to keep her from the howling winds. of a high hangs long. It rolls and flows all down abreast. Please see for me if a high's hanging long. For that's the way I remember her best. I'm wondering if she remembers me at all. Many times I've often prayed in the darkness of my night. In the brightness of my day. If you're traveling the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine.